Welcome back to Anti-Media Radio. I am your host for the next hour, Jake Anderson. It's my name, the name they gave me. And I'm going to be going through a bunch of different issues today. We got a cool guest, really cool guest, writer from Occupy Democrats, who's going to give us his take on Trump's first 100 days. And weird time in the news. We're going to talk about it a little bit here, get people caught up. I'm joined by my co-host DB. This is his last show for 3 weeks, and I'm going to miss you, man. You're going to be in Europe, right, DB?
I am, man. So I'm going to the belly of the beast.
Yeah. You should make sure to go to a castle and take a picture of it and put it on Facebook.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to be in Southern Europe, and from what I've been watching on various channels, it's quite tumultuous over there. So I'm curious to see if I'll see it where I'm going or if it's just been buried
Well,
by a.
you should make sure you go to a castle and take a picture and put it on Facebook.
Yeah, there'll be none of that stuff going on while I'm over there. I'm not taking any time to
Yeah.
be journoing any of this stuff. I'll leave it to somebody else.
It'll be interesting to get your take on that, because you're kind of the king of alt history, as I like to call it. You have a unique interpretation of many historical events, and so I'll be and you know be curious to get your take on what this place called Europe is like. I hear
I
it's
hear it's ending as we know it
kind
as
of
we
like a
speak.
yeah. Well, if France, if yet another major country ducks out of the European Union, yeah, it's. That it's gonna eviscerate the European economy. And
Yeah, I can't see it lasting, Jake, because of the gut job they did on Greece. Every country knows that that's what's next for them, and I'm not going to be visiting Greece, but I wish I was. And I've just heard really that their infrastructure's even been sold to China and other investors. So that's a worst case scenario for global capitalism right there.
So, one quick little story here. It's not what I've been writing about. I've been writing about Elon Musk's brain machine
Great
interface.
article, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it was just, dude, the thing I read, it was from an incredible site that I just discovered called Wait But Why. And it basically was like a 40,000 word breakdown. This guy like went into the heart of Neuralink and Elon Musk's new venture, and it's seriously one of the greatest posts I've ever seen on the internet. It
Jake,
starts
have you ever researched the Bionic Dolphin program?
No.
So basically what they did
Sounds
was they,
sexy, though. Say that.
yeah, well, what they did was they created an organelle that would copy a microprocessor. So they spliced human and dolphin stem cells and injected it in a baby dolphin in utero. And the organelle, I guess, grew into the dolphin's brain, and now the dolphin can speak telepathically. So I think you're not too far off, man. What we've been talking about with technology advance, with using electronics and inorganic materials, that's going to be reserved for the slave class. The upper class are going to have actual organelles they grow that do the same thing.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts, some of these projections, and it's not just Musk, it's other people. Facebook's anticipating it, and basically any tech magnate or guru is anticipating this kind of technology. But if you want to read more about it, go to theantimedia.org and look for, oh God, I can't remember what it's called, but Elon Musk is in the title. It's about the brain machine interface, and it gets pretty nuts going into the future. Basically, 20, 30 years from now, we're essentially going to be communicating with our thoughts. We'll be able to control physical objects with our thoughts because everything will be interconnected with a grid, and we'll have a what's called a neural lace. We'll be outfitted with the neural lace, and we'll have conversations. You'll have conversation with someone in your mind. You will
Don't
share.
forget that the central authority will have override, and they'll be able to get in without your knowledge
Oh,
and
of course.
consent.
That's of course. I mean, with great promise comes great peril. With any great technology, there will be hacking, there will be trolling, there will be surveillance. I mean, it's going to be just like now. We have this incredible tool of the internet, and it's being appropriated,
But you can leave your cell phone at home when you go to the store, and no one's none the wiser when you have it inside you and you can't turn it off and you have no way of knowing. I mean, your cell phone is recording everything you do and you can't take the battery out. So, I mean, we're living in that world now, but we're living in it by choice. When it doesn't become a choice, unfortunately, we bounce back to the reason why the Second Amendment was even created. And people have to, I guess, make that decision. Are they going to go ahead with this? What Lucent Technologies is developing right now with microchipping? Are they going to go with that? Or are they going to fight against it? Well, I guess we'll
Well,
see.
realistically, I think it's going to be a lot like the decision of whether you use the internet now.
But not if it's forced on you to be part of the economy, though.
Hopefully by then, we'll have stronger encryption methods. And that's what we have to hope for. Well, I mean, I would argue that the economy incentivizes one to use the internet just as much now as it will then. I mean, to really participate in the economy, you have to be internet savvy, which means you have to go online, which means you have to be tracked. It's very difficult to, I mean,
I
you can
guess
be.
you can just, you don't have to take it home with you, Jake. Like, you can go to a strip club and
Okay.
leave your cell phone at home. You know what I mean?
That's a great idea. I'm gonna, I actually live right across the street from a strip club. I don't.
Better yet, you can leave your cell phone somewhere else, then go home, go to sleep, go do a bunch of stuff that you're not supposed to do, and then go, no, I was always at this place. Just track where my phone was. I mean, duh.
Yeah, that's pretty nuts. I mean, you'll be able to share experiences. It'll be like it'll take virtual reality to the next level. I mean, it's basically, you'll be able to share a full-fledged experience. It'll be entirely new art forms that'll be created. You will be able to convey an emotion. Someone will be able to experience the emotion that you're experiencing. So when you say, you know how I feel, or you know what I mean, or you know what I'm saying, oh,
Didn't they make a movie about this?
people will know exactly what. Well, there's a few. There's one called Strange
Strange
Days.
times.
Strange Days. There was a
Strange days, yeah.
video flashbacks. There's been a ton of movies about it. This has been in science fiction lore for as long as Philip K. Dick was writing, and even before that. But we're talking about this really happening. The brain machine interface. Elon Musk is, I mean, he's at the forefront of electric cars with Tesla. He's at the forefront of getting all our eggs off, one planet with SpaceX. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and aggrandize the man, but he's really doing some incredible things. And look, there's dangers associated with it. But I'll tell you what, if you can experience what someone else is feeling, I would argue that that is an opportunity to enhance the empathy our race feels for itself.
But what if the predator class simply doesn't feel it but can instead mimic emotion? So that's worthless on them, unfortunately.
Well, half glass empty, dude. But yeah,
I'm
I
not even a Luddite at all. I know that everything they're gonna do is being used to just tighten the noose more and more and more. It's like we are that ultimate lobster in that slow boil.
It's going to get crazy. In the meantime, we're going to still have to deal with the crazy old normal elites and politicians. And here to suss that out with us a little bit is a really phenomenal writer, phenomenal thinker for Occupy Democrats. Lou, I'm about to butcher your last name, buddy. I think it's Colagiovanni. Am I right?
It's very close. It's phonetic pronunciation.
Yeah, I'm guessing, but that is that correct?
Well, you pronounce my last name Kel Giovanni, like K-E-L, but nobody knows that. You can't hold it against people. I just tell them that they pronounced it correctly and move on. I don't have to suss it out with them.
Well, I mean, ultimately, the most important thing in life is pronouncing one's name correctly, right? You know, so, but hey, man, it's great to have you on the show. I've been a fan of your writing for a while, and I follow your Facebook posts incessantly because you have this kind of great, witty, Hunter S. Thompson style, cantankerous way of putting your thoughts across. But what I like most about it is that you are very well researched and fact checked. I've used you as a source before. I've used one of your Facebook posts as a source before, which is probably not, you know, good, but I did it. And I like DB, like the two, both of you, I have met in person once and had great conversations. And so when I was in Las Vegas, met, it was a great conversation. So I wanted to have you on the show. So thanks for coming on. And I consider you somewhat of an expert on the travesty that is, well, I consider it the travesty of Trump. And I remember when in the first couple of weeks of his presidency, you posted, I'm just now realizing that I'm going to be writing about this man for the next, every day for the next 4 years. And I thought that was pretty funny. How are you holding up on that front?
It's a special kind of hell to have to write about Donald Trump every day of your life. But, you know, that's just the way that it is. I would prefer to be put out of business entirely and have nothing to write about. But that's not the world we live in. That's not the society that we live in. Also, I appreciate, you know, you saying all those nice things about reading my stuff and comparisons and everything else. And it's very flattering. And we had a good time when we met in Las Vegas. Had some drinks, had some people with me. That's a whole other story how that evening ended. Mm-hmm. And probably not appropriate for this show, but yeah.
Let's talk about war instead.
Okay.
We could go with Trump's first 100 days, but first, I think, to me, the most interesting thing that's been going on recently is war escalation and Trump essentially abandoning his base, bombing Syria, bombing Afghanistan, and he's basically kind of completely reversed course on his, well, he's not exactly regime changing, but he's definitely like heading in that direction, it seems like, and even talk of a preemptive strike on North Korea, perhaps that's in the cards. You know, when the bombing first took place, I went on InfoWars and Breitbart, and I looked at all the comment threads to try and get a feel for how his base felt, and they were not happy. What sense do you get about how this is going to affect Trump, these war actions of his, and how far do you think he'll go with it?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that I agree that it negatively impacts Trump's base. I mean, these are the type of people who, you know, a lot of them voted for economic reasons, but many voted for culture war reasons. Many voted because they're against Islam in all of its forms. So this idea that Trump, you know, getting involved in the Middle East annoys his base, I'm not sure with. I don't think it really hurts him at all because the rest of his presidency has been so piss poor that he needs something to distract from this entire litany of failures that has been since the beginning of January, right? I don't think it bothers people.
You're kind of breaking up a little bit for me. Hey, DB, is he breaking up for you, or am I breaking up? Or
No. It's no, I hear him.
Am I breaking up? Sorry, guys. I mean, I'm Skyping on a phone, so.
Apparently, it's me that can't hear you very well. Anyway, proceed. I'm sorry. Proceed with what you were saying.
Well, it doesn't matter who the president of the United States is to continue the Middle East policy. I'm sure listeners will disagree, but you go back and you look at the comments made by General Wesley Clark, you know, the retired general who was running for president over a decade ago. He was talking about, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, right? How he was talking about the United States had a plan to take out all these countries.
Absolutely.
Right? You know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely, yeah.
So the United States has had this plan with Iran being the premium prize, right? They want to, Iran is, of course, another regime change in Iran. We saw, well, that's been working out for the last 50 years after that situation. So to me, there's no doubt that the United States' prerogative has always been to eventually try and take Syria so that they can move closer to conquering Iran, which is kind of
against their foreign policy now, which is to create disarray in the region with which to begin. But Trump's going along entirely with what the United States in general has been doing. You know, it doesn't matter who the president is.
And why do you think that is? Because he came in and he really postured himself as someone who is not going to get caught up. You know, he said, you know, America first. I mean, you know, nothing says America first like bombing an airfield in Syria, right? I mean, what do you think? Did the deep state get to him? Did the dark forces running the shadow government, you know, however you want to call it, what is causing Trump to, in my opinion, commit political suicide here?
Well, I mean, there's several points to be made with that. In terms of political suicide, think about this. Never in the history of the United States of America has a sitting president at war lost re-election, ever, right? Americans are much more comfortable keeping their commander-in-chief who they are when there's a war. So, and I'm sure Trump isn't looking at it from a historical perspective. But that's the reality of what we're dealing with. I don't find it to be political suicide at all. You know, war is very, very profitable for certain people. You know, you get to hire contractors to build things and then blow things up and then build them again. Get to pay for all the military people, right? There's a lot of money to be made with all of this, and Trump's been trying to jumpstart the economy. It's no secret that war improves economies, right?
Yeah.
So
the economy actually isn't that bad right now, compared to where it was. Well, you know what?
But Jake, you're on the coast, man, and I'm telling you, in parts in the Midwest and the South, it is third world, dude.
Yeah, I know. I as soon as I said it, I realized it was wrong. I guess in terms of numbers speaking, but no, you're right, Blue. I mean, it's war is money. That's one of the oldest truisms in politics. So I guess, you know, from that perspective, you're right.
Well, it's whatever. Jake, you get onto this concept of war in the Middle East anyway, and I'm preaching to the choir when I'm talking to this audience. I really enjoy having the opportunity to come on to Anti-Media Radio. This is not my, it's not my core audience, you know. I know the editor-in-chief, Nick Burnaby, right? And I really much enjoy being having an opportunity to talk about these issues. But you guys already know that when the United States goes to war, it's not for a righteous reason, right? You can't. People have to go all the way back to World War II, and even then you can begin to talk about how the United States baited Japan into an economic war for righteous reasons. There isn't any righteous wars going on. It's all for profit. It's not to protect Americans' freedoms or liberties. It's not because these individuals in the United States hate freedom. That's the stupidest thing anybody believes. That's a moron. Okay? It's about money. And Donald Trump, for, you know, his own piece, said repeatedly that, yeah, he was against the war in Iraq, but that's because it was a losing proposition. But he said the United States should have stayed in Iraq to capture Iraq's oil, right? So why wouldn't he go into other countries and try and take their oil as well? To me, it seems very obvious what Trump's prerogative is. He wants to fluff up his numbers, because even though he has a majority in both congressional houses, not accomplishing very much, so he needs something to point towards. To say, hey, you know, my presidency isn't going so bad. And I think we're going to get to 100, you know, his first 100 days, which we can talk about. But look at where he's sitting right now. Lowest approval ratings ever of a president at this point, ever.
Right.
Can't crush Obamacare, which is an entirely different subject. Said he was going to do it, couldn't do it.
Yep.
His entire presidency has been an embarrassment. It's been an utter failure. So, yeah, I don't remember who published the story, but President Trump is looking for his Deutschmark fire. He's looking for his Reichsmark fire so that he can institute different penalties and prerogatives against the American people, right? Well, and this furthers those ends. It's just the beginning.
So maybe then you agree with Noam Chomsky, and Trump needs a false flag terror attack to secure the next couple wars. Am I right?
I mean... There's no doubt that Trump's been looking for that. He's been demonizing millions of people. He's been demonizing Hispanics. He's been demonizing individuals of the Muslim faith, trying to rationalize taking away the rights of Americans, right? Trump's already, you know, we're all in the journalism business. And, you know, Trump has made it a point that he wants to sue journalists, right?
Right.
Trump
yeah.
isn't an individual. He's not an individual who is in favor of Americans having full breadth of their rights according to the Constitution. That's just not who he is. So absolutely, he's going to use this as an excuse. Eventually, you know, provoke individuals towards attacking the United States, saying, "Oh my goodness, look at them! Now they're attacking us. Now we have to take away your rights to secure your freedom. And why do you hate freedom so much that you don't want the government to do what's necessary to protect you?" I mean, it's circular logic, and that's been going on in the entirety since Trump has taken office.
Right. Well, that's been the template for the last 15 years. And, you know, going back even before, I mean, Wesley Clark was speaking. I mean, even before that, you had Project for a New American Century in the late 90s, in which the neocons planned this kind of sequence of wars that was going to take place. It was going to happen, you know, regardless. But it sure seemed like 9/11 came around at a perfect time to, you know, christen the Patriot Acts and, you know, usher in the national security state, the surveillance state, all these things that now are pretty common. But, you know, if you had tried to do these things during the 90s, it wouldn't have happened. They needed a terrorist attack for it to happen. And I fully expect that there, if there's some kind of attack while Trump is in office, we will see something that makes the Patriot Act look like toilet paper, and it's going to be scary.
There's a couple of points I would make. I mean, first point is in the 90s, say it wouldn't have passed, but after the Oklahoma City bombing, for example, they passed sweeping surveillance laws then, right? Getting into the minutia about Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. If anybody wants to read a real interesting book, it's The Reason Why They Hate Us, A Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace by Gore Vidal, who corresponded with McVeigh while he was in prison. And there's wide belief that McVeigh, you know, didn't act alone. If you look at the strategics of it, doesn't make a whole lot of sense from a forensic standpoint. And, you know, secondary point about the surveillance state is it was a great coincidence that the United States of America had spent billions of dollars to build this surveillance mechanism, right? But had no legal way to enact it.
Right.
And then lo and behold, suddenly there's this terrorist attack in the United States that, once again, doesn't make a whole lot of sense on 9/11. And instantaneously, this surveillance mechanism is put into place and instituted, and everybody's happy that it happened. Immediately following 9/11, it's something like 70-80% of people in a poll said they would gladly give away some of their liberties to feel protected. Of course, 8 years later after the fact, that number shrunk down to about 20%. So there's the emotional impact argument that could be made why people do these things. And you can understand people being afraid. They have, you know, children, mortgages. They don't want bad things to happen. The people who need to hear this type of stuff aren't necessarily listening to anti-media radio to get the minutia of everything, right? They just get spoon-fed what is told to them from corporate entities and corporate interests to make them believe, you know, the march towards war. So, yeah.
Well, people want that comfort. They want to think that they're in a holy war. People will get comfort from being at war for some sick reason, and it certainly was a part of Trump's first 100 days now. And what is your take on, obviously you don't like his first 100 days. What do you think are some, you know, what are couple of the most notable misachievements from his first 100 days?
Listen, it's not that I'm an independent person. I work for Act Right Democrats, biggest Democratic website in the world. But, you know, if you want to look me up, I've done a lot of bad things to members of the Democratic Party as well to prove that. I'm not a party loyalist.
Right, I know. I know that, yeah.
Sure. In terms of his 100 days, I mean, there have been dozens of failures, the biggest being can't get rid of Obamacare because, A, the majority of people like it, and they don't have the votes in the Senate to completely dismantle it. What they wanted to do was remove the funding from Obamacare rather than dismantle it because it required a different amount of votes. And the Senate has showed through the confirmation hearing of the new Supreme Court justice that they're willing to bend and break all commonalities and norms to accomplish their end. So that's the biggest, most humiliating thing that has happened to Trump, that he can't follow through on, because it's not that people don't like the Affordable Care Act. They just don't like Obamacare's name attached to it, right? Individuals, when you call it the Affordable Care Act, which many individuals confuse between Obamacare, they think they're two different entities. When you break down and start asking people about the specific provisions, like, okay, I'll ask you guys just, you know, a quick question. Before the Affordable Care Act came into place, what do you think the amount of money that was required percentage-wise? Let's say you get paid $100 for your insurance premiums. Before Obamacare was enacted, what do you think the percentage of that money had to go towards your hair, go towards your health care by law? What do you think the percentage was?
Couldn't tell you.
Well, the percentage, a lot of people guess, like, what, 50%? That seems fair. The actual thing is the number was zero. Nothing, there was no law written that said if you paid $100 for your medical insurance, that any of your money had to actually go towards your care, right? Under Obamacare, one of the provisions says that 85% of all the money you spend on health care for your insurance goes towards your health care. You explain it to people like that, who thinks it's a bad idea? I go out and I talk to people all the time. Nobody's ever said it's a bad idea. But at the same time, they still don't like Obamacare. They still voted for Trump. And Trump has majorities in both houses and still was unable to repeal the legislation. So huge failure. An embarrassment to him. And you'll notice that he doesn't talk about it that much anymore. Bloviating loaf that he is doesn't say anything. And that's very telling.
It looks like the same thing could happen to tax reform as well.
Well, Trump has no interest in reforming tax reform. I mean, people can look up Barack Obama gave the citizens of the United States the biggest tax cut in the history of the United States several months into his first term, right? In terms of Donald Trump wanting to correct tax reform, if they wanted to do it, they could do it. They have majorities in both houses. The fact that they're not doing it is telling. It shows that they have no intention on doing it. When Trump came into office, he promised that there would be, you know, a hiring freeze on federal employees because he wants to reduce the federal workforce. He wants to make it so the federal government isn't hiring as many people. And on Inauguration Day, he signs this order. But he's since lifted that order. Trump created he signed an executive order that there's going to be a requirement for every federal regulation that they initiate, two must be eliminated. He signed it in January, and here we are almost in May. That hasn't happened. The law that he signed in, he hasn't been able to use because you can't get rid of, wouldn't say can't. We live in a universe of unlimited possibilities, but he's been unable to accomplish that. Now, President Trump said there's going to be a 5-year ban on White House and congressional office holders being able to be in office and then go to the private sector, right? He issued an executive order immediately coming into office. But in terms of Congress, which is much more important than, you know, listen, you're a copy person at the White House, and now you can't leave and get a job somewhere else that might be considered lobbying for 5 years. Okay. But members of Congress, once they leave office or they get a more lucrative job offer, that's where the big money is. It's like, hey, do this vote for us, make our company money, and then you're guaranteed a job over here making 6, 7, 8 figures. Trump said he was going to do it, but the only person who actually brought forth legislation was a little-known congressman, Peter DeFazio. He's a Democrat. He brought forth. He only has 3 co-sponsors for the bill. Trump has never tried to push that through, and he could. They have majorities. So he made promises, and now he's lying about the inability to get them done while fluffing himself. You know, Trump said that – sorry, I'm going on. But, you know, Trump said that it's a ridiculous standard, this 100-day benchmark. Even though he made all these promises, and now that he realizes that he can't do it, oh, suddenly, whoa, it was me. It's a ridiculous standard. It's like, you're the one who made the promises, my friend, and now you can't live up to it. And if you're the president of the United States, the most powerful and influential man in the world, you don't just represent people who agree with you, who voted for you, you represent everybody. And he made a promise, and he broke it. Dozens of promises. We don't have time to go through all of them. Otherwise, we'd be sitting here for 14 hours and I'll bore you guys with my wonky talk. But that's the reality, right?
All right. So, Lou, you write for a site called, a very popular site, Occupy Democrats. Now, I think I know what that means, Occupy Democrats. To me, it sounds pretty much like this is a hostile takeover of the Democratic Party. Now, me and DB talk about this all the time because we're sort of on the same political spectrum. He calls it, DB, what's the color that you call us? We're not red.
Purple.
Purple?
Yeah. We're way more blue. We're way more blue than red, but we're a little bit conservative. Like, we realize the government's getting ridiculously huge and needs to be reined in, but
Well, I have traces of anarchy in me as well. We're gonna get to that. But as far as you and your political views and your role in terms of kind of framing where the Democratic Party is right now, there's clearly an internal war going on between the progressive side and the elite establishment side. And
well,
one of the
Bernie won the hearts and minds, dude, and that's really all that it is. It's just that the dinosaurs still have the wallets.
Right.
That's just
right.
Where it's at.
And so the issue right now seems to be, can progressive dismantle this elite establishment and reconnect with the working class? Because the Democrats, I mean, they lost the election because they had one of the most unpopular candidates in history, Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
And they, you know, a lot of people have said they've kind of lost the soul of their party. Do you see corporatism as, you know, the poison, the cancer inside the Democratic Party right now?
Well, you know, corporatism poisons both parties in the United States. Individuals who lobby and pay money towards campaigns are the bane of American democracy. The Democrats aren't unique in this, right? We only have a two-party system. Now, I heavily campaigned for Bernie Sanders. I sued Hillary Clinton's campaign lawyer and issued grievances against her with the Nevada Bar Association for committing crimes, and nothing happened. But that's not the point. The Democratic Party, as it sits right now, has itself in a quagmire. Yes, it is beholden to corporate interests, but also the majority of the party isn't moving towards the values of American citizens. You know, it's... You have all, there's, to me, there are three parts of the Democratic Party, right? You have this kind of corporatist structure, then you kind of have the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren Democrats, then you have the ultra-leftists with which the culture war is being waged against, you know, individuals who believe in safe spaces and who believe in microaggressions and stuff like that. And the ultra-left is what has galvanized Trump's base. And this isn't something that I think is understood. I think Democrats are very cowardly. I don't think they're willing to get their hands dirty. I think when you're playing against, you know, an enemy or an opponent, whatever one wishes to consider the Republican Party, I've for years said that Democrats need to do much more dirty things. They don't try. Individuals want to take the high road, and it's great. You can walk on the high road, and now Republicans control the White House, the Senate, Congress, and the U.S. Supreme Court. So while walking the high road and patting themselves on the back for being nice guys and not twisting arms and not doing what they should have done, what do they have now? Now where are they? Just sitting in a dark room complaining about the way that things are when they bellowed that they wanted to take the high road. It's not right to be a bad person or be aggressive, right? It's shunned upon in the Democratic Party to be an aggressive individual. It's shunned upon in the Democratic Party. I live in Nevada, right? Open carry state. I don't have a problem with individuals owning firearms. Democratic Party in general is against firearms. It wants to limit weapons. Furthermore, when's the last time that you can name a Democratic candidate that actually talked about cutting taxes, right? They talk about tax reform, talk about making taxes, you know, more detrimental to individuals with more money. But what about cutting taxes? Why is this such a difficult concept for Democrats to grasp? The more money people get to keep, the happier they are, regardless of the programs that it would impact. And to not understand this, that, you know what, people are selfish and they don't really care if they're going to save money 2 years down the road or if they're going to have an extra $70 a week in their paycheck. They want the $70. And that's why Democrats constantly lose. They create these scenarios where everybody has to be protected at all times, which I understand. And they want to, you know, continually pull money from individuals. I can understand why Democrats constantly lose. And that's why I'm not a Democrat, because I'm not going to play for the losing side, unfortunately. I grew them lots of things, but their platform's a loser. It's been a loser. Sorry, Democratic listeners. Sorry, fans. That's just the way that it is. You have to...
Well, this is anti-media.
They had a shot, man. They had a populist president that people actually loved. So
absolutely. Absolutely. And you could get into all that. We're not having a Bernie Sanders show. The last time I was anti-media, I was pastoring the listeners to vote for Bernie Sanders. You know, ideologically wise, we disagree on certain things, but please vote for Bernie Sanders. Democratic Party rigged the primary system. I don't care what anybody else has to say. You can look at the reduced polling places by 75% in Arizona. 75%. Look at the state of New York that has absolutely ridiculous primary registration rules, where one has to be registered, like, what, 4 or 5 months in advance to vote? When Bernie Sanders wasn't receiving television coverage, wasn't receiving coverage in the newspaper, was considered this fringe candidate when he first started. Even though he was wildly popular, had tens of thousands of people showing up to his rallies, couldn't get any media coverage. And at the same time, the Democratic Party said you had to be registered 5 months in advance when Bernie was just coming on the scene. That's why Democrats lost. They lost because they disenfranchised individuals, which is probably why a lot of individuals, you know, with this network, anarchistic theory and philosophy, a lot of disenfranchised people that just don't want to play the game anymore, and they've just completely moved to that ideology instead. So I understand. I think there are different solutions that can be had other than just walking away.
I think this current election cycle made enemies out of people that were indifferent before, and it's going to create a generational shift, because I think they lost any millennial base because they're getting a backlash now in the colleges that aren't ultra liberal. They're like, dude, you've taken it so far to the left now that it's ridiculous. We're never voting for your party like ever again. You're going to have to like change the name and change your whole top leadership. Like Perez basically was the nail in the coffin.
With the subject of Perez, Keith Ellison is a very interesting progressive figure. He said a lot of things before he came into office that could be used against him. I mean, it's just a fact that Mr. Ellison is the first and only Muslim representative in the United States Congress. And I thought it was a big mistake to try and put Ellison in the DNC chair. I thought it was a big mistake because then you give ammunition to the right. You give column inches to the right. You give talking points to the right about the Democrats have literally given their control of their party to a Muslim. Not that I'm against that, but that's the way that it would have played. Perez is a disgrace too. Both of the options weren't good. Maybe Ellison, in terms of ideology, was suited more towards the position, but his belief system, and we live in the United States, people are free to believe whatever they want, but his belief system would have been used against him. That's not why he lost, by the way, but that's my opinion why he shouldn't have been there with which to begin.
So in terms of direction moving forward, I mean, I guess I'll put it right to you. What do you think will happen in a 2018 midterms, and who do you think the Democrats will run in 2020?
2020 is far away. 2018 is a little bit more certain. We have right now over 50% more. I think the number is 58% more Democratic congressional candidates have thrown their hat into the ring than this time 2 years ago. That's a huge increase. And there's expected to be hundreds more, possibly up to 1,000 congressional candidates. And that's a very good thing. I think Democrats have a great chance of taking back the House. Mathematically, it makes absolutely no sense that the Democrats have a chance to take back the Senate, because the Senate's broken down into, for listeners who don't know, want a quick civics lesson. Senators serve 6-year terms, but those terms are broken down into the elections for Senate happen every 2 years, you know, twice in the midterms and once in the general election. And right now, there are 24 seats that are up for grabs. And I'm pretty sure that the Democrats only have a chance at 8 of those seats. The Democrats are already occupying 2/3 of those seats. So are Democrats going to flip all of those seats in 2018? I really, really don't think so. And even then, it wouldn't matter. It's not going to help the Democrats take back the majority in the Senate. So Democrats find themselves in a very, very poor position at the moment. Sorry, my dog is barking.
Oh, that son of a bitch.
Vicious guard dog, dude.
My dog is barking. But yeah, Democrats have no chance to take anything back. Hold on, we'll answer my door live, see who's here.
I wonder if it's the CIA. What if Lou were killed like right here live on the show? Let's actually,
a trained killer just walked into my house, but it's okay. It's okay. Sorry, buddy. We're doing a show live here.
Don't worry about it, man.
All right. So
there's probably about 10 anarchists out there listening, wondering why the hell we're talking about Democrats.
Sometimes you have to have a long obituary, Jake.
That's true. Written in cursive. So, you know, I've been talking about this for a while in terms of how to approach. Obviously, right now there's a metastasizing cancer in our government right now, and there doesn't seem to be any logical way of going about approaching it because there's so many different points of view and so many different disagreements over the role of government. And, you know, so I've been arguing that what we need is a kind of coalition of anti-establishment and anti-war groups across the political spectrum. One, you know, characteristics that unite the alt-right and the alt-left, and of course I'm not going to make an argument for either side. I'm certainly on the alt-left side and not the alt-right side, but they are both firmly against the entrenched corporate establishment. They are both anti-war. Is there not a way to see a kind of coalition of alt-right and alt-left voices speaking out against the big banks, speaking out against against war, perpetual war? It seems to me this would be a way. You know, both Ron Paul and Kucinich and Ralph Nader have spoken about the necessity of some kind of coalition. Do you see something like that? Would you agree with something like that?
I would agree with that, but realistically, does that have a chance of happening? Realistically, no.
Well, no, I mean,
you pose a question.
Ron Paul and Ralph Nader have started a movement. It's just not picking up any steam because no one is willing to work with someone with whom they have a disagreement. And that's the problem right now. Is even in anarchy, you know, even a field like anarchism, you have the ANCAPs, you have the ANCOMs, and they hate each other. They hate each other probably more than they hate the government itself. And no one can agree to disagree and move forward with a common purpose right now.
I agree with you. I think that's why it's very important for, you know, somebody from my position to come onto this network to have a conversation. We probably don't agree on everything, right? But we can have a civil discussion about stuff. And conversation and debate, most importantly, is not what happens in the United States, especially free-flowing debate. Now it's, you know, timed questions and answers and everything else. But removing that lamenting, there should be a movement of these individuals because indeed they do agree. But are you going to see some large coalition of anarchists and libertarians and anti-war Democrats coming together? Probably not. And part of the reason you're not going to see it is because a lot of these anti-war Democrats are hypocrites and make me sick to my stomach.
Me too, brother.
Anti-war Democrats, okay, President Obama was committing all these drone strikes all around the world, committing drone strikes in, I don't know, more countries than you can count on both of your hands. Where are these
Seven different countries.
Yeah, where are these anti-war Democrats protesting then, right? Once a Democrat's out of office and a Republican starts talking about, you know, creating war in North Korea, which is an interesting subject, or, you know, continuing the perpetual war going on in the Middle East, where were they the last 8 years? And all of a sudden they're coming out saying war is wrong, war is bad. It's only bad because there's a Republican. It's not because they're fundamentally against war. It's not because they've thought about the nuance of it. It's just because the person is affiliated with the wrong party and they're cheap and they're stupid.
I have multiple friends that are guilty of this. And of course, you know, I'm guilty of it a little bit too. Did I protest war as much as I should have during the Obama years? No, but I didn't deny it was happening. I frequently called him a war criminal and I received a lot of shit for it. And, you know,
the truth is it is ramping up under Trump, but like in a weird way, he's getting a pass because it was expected.
Nobody thought Donald Trump was going to come and grow daisies and sweet onions at the White House, right? They thought he was going to go ahead and he promised to completely eradicate radical Islam.
Right.
So, yeah, they expected him to initiate war. And is there going to be a coalition? It's interesting to me when you think about coalitions because there have been possibilities in the last year or so with coalitions. Like you could have had Black Lives Matter join up with the anti-gun movement right? Because the reason why a lot of people get shot, of course, for economic disparity, but also because there are just too many weapons in this country. You didn't see that coalition happen, and fundamentally they're on the same side of the fence. So this idea that people from different political ideologies are going to work together to end war, no. No, it's not happening. And it's not happening because they're hypocrites, sorry to say.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. And I think, you know, hypocrisy, you know, and I think a lot of it is that people feel disengaged from their country. They don't disengage from community and disengage from the products they consume, the food they consume. And, you know, so I've been looking into, the movement of agorism, which I think is pretty interesting. And so I'm interested in your take on, in the future, moving towards a more community-based, volunteerist, agorist-based community that, maybe frees people up a little bit from relying on both the state and corporations. Is that something that registers with you, or do you think it's just pipe dreams?
With this subject, I think it'd be interesting if maybe we get into a little debate with it. I don't know, because I'm sure my views are not going to agree with yours. The concept of what you're talking about works when everybody behaves in a judicious way, in a righteous way, a way which believes in justice. And my view is that people don't do that. People do what's easy. They do what's weak. They will always take the sly way out. And fundamentally, I disagree with that entire concept. So we're going to have 300 million people that are going to, adhere to rules and laws voluntarily. It's based on the idea that people will do what's right, and they're not going to do what's right. And I asked Mr. Burnaby to be able to speak on this subject over a year ago. I'm glad I can speak on it now. I mean, my personal belief is that anarchism in general is just kind of a ploy. It's a little bit of a joke, in my opinion. I just don't. It doesn't. There's no basis that it's going to work in our society. Let me tell you why. The only way in which anarchism actually works in American society, which is what I assume we're talking about, not anywhere else in the world, the government has to collapse for that to happen, which places these people in a really kind of cheap position talking about how great the world would be or how great the country would be and our society would be if this were to ever happen. Well, we know it's probably not going to. And also, and this is kind of really what bothers me about anarchists, individuals who are anarchists, because the government has to collapse for their worldview to come to fruition, have no incentive to try to fix the problems in our society,
right,
through a legislative means. What incentive do they have if the government has to collapse for this to happen, right? They want things to go as badly as possible. And that's not something that I can abide by. I think individuals, every member of society should be doing their part to try to alleviate the problems. And anyway, you go ahead. I have another point to make, but I won't.
Every anarchist, when they grow up, becomes an agorist, and then they want their own farm. And then that's the natural progression of things, man. You can go do your own thing. Just buy 10 acres. You're golden.
I got no problems with people who want to save rainwater and want to live off of the grid and do want to be prosecuted for not having the correct copper tubing to their homes, which is required by most city laws. Individuals have to have a water hookup and things like that. I mean, that's nonsense. If you want to live off the grid and just want to go ahead and be by themselves, that's fine. I don't find that how it impugns on an individual's freedom. What is interesting to me with anarchists is I haven't found too many that see the similarity with themselves and with people who believe in the rapture, these Christian fundamentalists.
Mm.
Do you guys know what the similarity is? You know what I'm talking about?
I'm feeling it. Expand.
Here's the fundamental similarity with these religious extremists and anarchists. As I already touched on, why anarchists have no incentive to do anything to fix the government, to fix the problems. Similarly, damn near equally, people who believe in the rapture believe the rapture is going to come when Earth goes completely to hell, right? And the great war between good and evil is going to propagate itself amongst the wicked. But before that happens, the entire world has to fall into despair. There has to be apocalypse, which means that individuals, people who believe in this, they have no incentive to do anything to fix anything. As a matter of fact, they have an incentive to make this apocalypse come as quickly as possible because they're greedy and selfish and want to get raptured off to heaven naked and do whatever it is that they do, right? And that's where anarchist philosophy and Christian fundamentalist philosophy come together. And for some reason, this point is missed on a lot of people. And to me, it's pretty cut and dry. It's pretty black and white. I don't know if people find that insulting, but tell me I'm wrong, right? Am I wrong here in drawing this conclusion?
I actually know. I've never heard that comparison before. I have frequently thought, because I communicate now with a lot of anarchists, and I have frequently felt that anarchy is a kind of subterfuge as a way of not engaging with the intricacies of the system. I do respect there's certain anarchists out there, like Derek Bros comes to mind, who is, you know, putting forth actionable
solutions. Mr. Bros followed his work for years.
Yeah, you know, actionable solutions, freedom cells, actually creating the change that he's talking about, solution oriented, and he's a rare example. But you know, I think that's the way forward. I think you push in that direction. You know, the extremes inform the mean, and I think as long as we keep pushing outwards, away from the manufactured consensus of what the government and what the media is telling us, I think we get closer to finding a place where people can start living more freely. But I agree with you that it's, you know, waiting for the government to collapse is a strange proposition, because at least initially, the chaos would be almost unimaginable.
Can you really think about these people? Think about a society that collapses. Have you been to Walmart lately? I mean, honestly, have you walked around the streets? You see these people walking around. Can you imagine these hundreds of millions of people with no rule, with no law, being able to do what they want under these new volunteerism guidelines? I mean, what a disaster that is being advocated. I can't imagine why anybody advocates for this at all, other than for the possibility of a utopia after there's a collapse, after there's this famine, after there's this tribalism in our society. Then maybe after all that, there's this promised land that's going to happen. And by the way, once the promised land doesn't come, what consequences are there to these people who advocate for it? The answer is there's no consequences, which is why it's empty rhetoric, which is why it's bullshit. I don't know if we can swear here, but that's what it is.
Oh, Jake, we
can say whatever the fuck we want. That's the good. Right. That's the good news about UCY.TV, which, right, by the way, is hosting us. And thank you to UCY.TV. DB, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I was just in Colorado, and some of the small towns are perfect places to just start your own thing, and they're not even that expensive. And it's probably a good test scenario for people to go up, and really it's pretty close to being free up there if you're in a small town. And you can still get to Denver in like an hour and a half or whatever.
I don't think it's a bad idea for people to do what they want in small groups, but we talk about the entirety of the United States society. Gentlemen, fortunately, we all know this. It doesn't make sense, right? We want to have these little groups, 100,000 people at a time, dotted over the country. It's great. Go right ahead. Have the ability to pursue happiness, and legislation on a local level prevents this very often, and that's wrong, right? And most anarchists really are pretty left-wing in terms of their beliefs, not in terms of, you know, guns or anything else, but in terms of, you know, individuals having more liberty. Yes, they are, and they are people who find themselves despondent at the corruption of the Democratic Party, and I don't disagree with them. I completely understand where they're coming from. This idea of taking your ball and going home while the society crumbles around you and do nothing, say nothing, you know, just letting the corruption steal their voices and steal their hearts, to me is just a tragedy. It's a waste of talent. And I encourage people to become involved in the political process. The United States government is corrupt, but the ideals with which Americans live by is not corrupt.
And for the alternate perspective on this, just so everyone knows, we will be having Derek Bros on the program next week, which will be an interesting counterpoint to this. In fact, it might be worth having both of you on at the same time to debate this. What do you think about that?
I'm a big fan of Derek. When I was hosting radio show Renegade Talk Radio, I tacitly invited him, but I never got anything nailed down. I mean, I'm a big fan of his work. I like what he, I like what Derek represents in terms of practical application. I just don't see it, but, you know, everybody has their right to their opinion.
They certainly do. God bless America, right? All right, well, something like that. So we've got a couple minutes left. DB, do you have any thoughts or questions? Or we have a lot. We got a live one on the. We got a, what's it called when you're fishing? We got a live one on the reel. Lou's just ready. He's just waiting to ask him something.
Oh man, I guess my question is, do you think that Trump has been gotten to? Because over the last, I guess, 14 days, he's just looked like a shell of himself, and he's just reversed course.
He's been gotten to in the idea that the simplicity to believe the United States government, how simple that it was, now that he sees this gigantic mechanism, you know, people talk about cut government. It's okay, cut what? Out of the hundreds of thousands of programs, cut what? What benefit is that? Trump's a person, simple thoughts for simple minds. I mean, think about some of the quotes that he said when we were talking about North Korea, which we could touch on still. You know, after listening for 10 minutes, Trump said, I realize it's not so easy. that's what he said. On the U.S. government, you can look up the quote. He said, I never realized how big it was. It's like, you're literally in charge of the whole fucking thing. You didn't realize how big it was when you're going to take this seat. I touch on a similar point 8 years ago because Barack Obama didn't have a whole lot of experience. And, oh, golly gee, we can't have somebody that's lacking in experience. Now have a guy who literally is in office, didn't realize how big it was. To me, it's an embarrassment. When he had Angela Merkel, right, he was trying to negotiate a deal with the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, right? And Merkel told him repeatedly, you can't make a trade deal with me. You have to negotiate with the European Union, not with Germany. He literally asked her 10 times until it got through his thick, stupid skull. And he said, okay, fine, we'll do a deal with Europe then. What does that tell you about the leader of the free world, the individuals in charge of protecting our rights and safeguarding the United States? It's embarrassing.
What did he think he was getting involved in exactly? I mean, he wants to run America like a corporation's run, and unfortunately, it's a little too complex for that. Well, there's the music for us. Lou, brilliant as always. Thank you so much for coming on. And I really want to set up you coming on and debating an anarchist. I think that would be just great entertainment. You down?
Sure, of course. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Glad to come back. I like doing these little steals. Maybe I'll change my mind. Maybe I won't. Maybe people will disagree with me. Yo, here we go. Go through the stereo.
You are listening to UCY.TV.